Real pleasure to have Robert Adamson with us tonight.
Thanks so much for that. It's great to be here, and especially with Joanne and Michael Palmer and so many ghosts of American poetry, of American poets that have been close to me in my life. I think I'll just start reading. I'll probably say things between the poems. I'll just read this first poem. It's in my new book. On the cover is a net needle and a bobbin that's carved from river cedar that my grandfather made. He died when he was 98, and that was quite a long time ago. And that was part of his legacy. He left me his net needles and his fishing nets. I was a fisherman when I was younger. He was a professional fisherman, and my father was. And this is listening to cuckoos. Two unchanging notes. To us, words. Always, always those high, elongated notes. Red-eyed coels with feathered earmuffs. Downward-ending notes that pour through a falling of light. Coming over the distances, words that don't change. Two notes remain. A split phrase, two words, meaning not exactly a self, not quite. The first day of spring, the moment of utterance, candor becomes the piercing, whistled syllables, penetrating the dark green of twilight. The storm birds call, two notes, two words, then cackle in the broken egg dawn, in the echoing light. Those birds, you know, that lay their eggs, eat the eggs, land in another bird's nest and eat the eggs, and then lay their own for the other birds to bring up. So you have these tiny sort of robins or something with these huge cuckoo chicks, exhausting the parents even faster than normal parents. Faster than human parents. This is a poem about my wife's uncle, who was a wonderful Hungarian poet called Miklós Rodnorty, one of the great poets of the world. He knew Apollinaire and hung out with Apollinaire in Paris. He also translated into Hungarian Verlaine, and he was in style and verbally like similar to Verlaine, although he wrote about tougher subjects. But there's no tougher subject than love. During the Second World War, he was interned in a prison camp, and he was being marched through by the fascists back to Budapest, and he was shot. And they found his poems in his jacket with a bullet through them. This is for him. The Green Shank. Miklós Rodnorty marched from forced labour in Yugoslavia back to Hungary, came to rest near a bend in the Redica, at what his translator describes a strange, lonely place, where the tributary joins the great river, the marshland, watched over by willows and high circling birds, condors perhaps. They appear in the notes and poems he was writing under a foamy sky. Huddled in a trench with the body of a friend who'd been shot in the neck, he wrote with a pencil stub in his notebook, quote, patience flowers into death. His wife's face blossomed in his head. Thinking of the petals of crushed flowers floating in a wake of perfume, he wrote to caress her neck. The fascist's bullets wiped out his patience. His written petals survive. Today, we listen to the news of war here in a river sanctuary. My wife's unbending will has created horizontal slats of cedar, verticals of glass, a Mondrian chapel of light. This afternoon, just before dark, the first greenshank arrived from the Hebrides, ignorant of human borders. Its migration technology is simple, feathers and fish fuel, cryptic colour and homing instinct. This elegant wader landed on a mooring, got ruffled in a westerly, then took off again. An acrobatic twister, it levelled down onto a mudflat, a lone figure that dashed across the shore, stood on one leg, then, conducting its song with its bill, came forward in a high-stepping dance. So I said, you know, that was Miklos giving us a sign. So I'll read some from my new book. First of all, you know, I'm just getting ideas as I stand here. I had it all planned out, but I decided I'd just do what I did last night and follow a kind of, I don't know what it is, an idea. This is a letter to Eurydice. Watercolour moon, window panes fogged up, outside the river slips by, an overhanging blackbutt branch inscribes the surface with a line across foaming runoff. Living near mudflats, I'm protected by mangroves in winter. The southerly rakes their curly heads. The green skirts are my windbreak. At the fork, these summer thoughts are silted up and become obscure. It's more than halfway into a big ebb, and my mind's a dark moat. If you get this far, watch it, and step on my dreams. You'll find they've been pulped. It's only flight that matters here. Take a break and fling your next thought onto the tide. In these parts, the lyrebird must carry its own cage on its back through swamps. I once believed this, but yesterday the bird suffered a stroke. It keeps falling to the ground, the ranger said. Nothing can be done. It's time to commiserate with the creature. All songbird, but not quite lyre. When Robert Duncan came to Australia, I invited him to Australia, and to my great surprise, he came. This is in 1977. He stayed in my house for a month and travelled around the country and read in each city. I've changed my life. But I took him in my grandfather's fishing boat. This is a poem about that, called Eurydice Reads Roots and Branches. Robert used to say, I often say I read when I read. I loved the way he would make no distinction between reading and writing, how equally important they were. Torchlight flares on the book's cover. Reading's difficult in the boat, and you wonder, is the helmsman distracted by light? On this river, there's only one destination, that dock on the other side. The pages are smeared by yellow light beams. What time of day is it? What day of the month? We continued the crossing, flowering gums, bees flying by polarized light, then watched a shape forming, an emerald blur of wings at the periphery of torchlight, a bee-eater hovering over words, over the hive of the book. We taste honey on our tongues, an orange beak flashes, and read to one another in the pitch dark, carried on the wings of words. I'll I'll read a kind of story poem. My grandfather had pigeons. They were around me since I was a child. My father and grandfather had all sorts of birds that were kind of utilitarian sort of birds. They were homing pigeons. And this poem's about my grandfather being a fisherman. And in those days, there was no refrigeration. There was a problem to get ice to keep the catch fresh. My grandfather's ice pigeons. My grandfather would walk into the house on a summer evening after his work, then empty his catch of mud crabs into the bathtub. They'd flow out in a stream of ice flurry from his 4-gallon drums, then settled in a heap of black and olive speckled claws, spiky legs and black flappers, waving frantically. One night my mother caught me holding a broomstick with an angry muddy's claw clamped around it. She ordered me to stay away from the crabs, reminding me why Uncle Eric lost his finger. My mother went back to the city. I stayed a week and my grandmother showed me what to do. First, throw one into a bucket of ice, slow it down, then bind the claws together with kingfisher blue twine in a slipknot. Old Dutch would come to take them to the co-op in his truck, packed into fish boxes, covered with ice. My grandfather would leave again for his next catch. He'd take some of the pigeons with him in a cage on the trawler. If he had a good haul, he'd let some of the birds go. When it came home, it was my job to ride my bike down into the town and order the ice. When I reached the co-op, Dutch would ask, "How many pigeons?" If there was more than one, it was a box of ice. A box of ice, a bird. He'd send the ice to my grandfather the next morning on the mail boat. They talk about the time Fafa got drunk up the river at Spencer. The river postman saw him in the mist one morning, balancing on the net boards at the stern of his boat, singing aloud, throwing pigeons at the sky. Talking of professional fishing, this is my first attempt. I'm going to write a series of poems for Lorene Neerdecker. And I went to Rock River. Peter O'Leary drove me to Woodland Patton, the wonderful bookshop in Milwaukee. And this is just might be the poem for a series. Well, it will be. So it's generalized. In a subway in New York City, Zhukovsky carefully watches a praying mantis on a page of newspaper in full defensive display. In a Milwaukee factory, Neerdecker listens to workers on their lunch break, yarning, lines drawn, some in books, others in sand, spinning tangles. Lorene sorting through her father's lines that hauled carp. Everything difficult. Even in hours writing lines of poetry, words came a letter at a time. Creating phrases, images of buckets tipped over with a light touch. Line breaks making sense of her sparse life. Rock River's pool. She changed the water level until she drew Zook and Basil Bunting to the front door. Green tree frogs croaked. A barn owl cleared the bone from its throat. Sound of a paddle splash. Then a water rat drops down from the plank wood, dock to scurry under the net boards. There was her father's bent back as he pulled them home, along with the shuddering catch. Carp scales caught in mesh were silver coins in broad shafts of the late sun. Nighttime, after the dishes, a dream of hands roughened in oak sacks. Dawn, starling chatter and rat shit. Lorene watches a white moth on a stalk of blossoming rose mallow. After the soft crack of duck eggs, she sits at her breakfast table, writing lines including factory talk, her way, until it seems to matter. Now I'll go back to this book. There's a poet called Francis Thompson, an English poet, who lived from 1859 until 1907. You probably know of him. He wrote a very famous poem called The Hound of Heaven, and it sold thousands and thousands of copies in America. He didn't do so well in England. It was after he died that it sold. It was promoted by the Jesuit Society. So it was in every Catholic school. In The Hound of Heaven, he says, "The Hound of Heaven followed me down the labyrinthine ways of my own mind." And it goes on. It's wonderful. He's a kind of like a Robertson Jeffers sort of poet. But instead of loving birds and animals, probably a bit more than he should have, with Robertson Jeffers, Francis Thompson loved his Lord Jesus probably a bit more than he should have. But he had the help of opium, you know, laudanum. In those days it was called the black drops. You could just buy it in the chemist. This is as late as 1900. This is okay. Francis Thompson. He slept by the Thames in newspaper, a makeshift blanket, fevered talk, opium pipe, black drops. How much did it cost for his pencil to move across paper? At dawn, a fox limped by, coughed up a sparrow at his feet. Francis addressed envelopes in a curved hand to enfold his poems, posting them off from Charing Cross. When they appeared in print, he'd worry about his best lines. A century later, I read The Hound of Heaven by a river in New South Wales and heard a dark chuckle before his running laughter. Attention shifts, revelation grips. That's got echoes of Charles Olson, that line, last line. I wanted that. Like, you know, the jungle leaps in. When the attention shifts, the jungle leaps in. Something like that. Garden poem. This is for my wife, Juno. Sunlight scatters the wild bees across a blanket of flowering lavender. The garden grows visibly. In one morning, native grasses push up, tough and lovely as your angel's trumpets. At midday, the weather, with bushfire breath, walks about talking to itself. A paper wasp zooms above smooth river pebbles. In the trees, possums lie flat on leafy branches to cool off. The cats notice, then fall back to sleep. This day has taken our lives to arrive. Afternoon swings open, although the mechanics of the sun require the moon's white oil. Daylight fades to twilight, streaking bottlebrush flowers with shade. A breeze clatters in the green bamboo and shakes its lank hair. At dinner time, the French doors present us with a slice of night, shining clear. A Naples yellow moon outlines the ridges of the mountains. All this neatly laid out on the dining room table across patches of moonlight. I've got another. I've been thinking of what the soul means. What is a soul? Joanna, I had it in a poem back there. And are you okay? Yep. Okay?
Sure.
So I started looking at different philosophers and people that write about that sort of thing. And I finally got back to Spinoza, and I remembered reading once that he was he used to make lenses and polish lenses. He was one of the first people to make a lens, a microscope and a telescope. So I wrote this poem, "Oh, my soul's friend, just once, take some advice. Reach back into myths of flight. Measure a peregrine falcon's primary wing feathers. Check semi-plumes for bird mites. Hold your bearings. The law could break by daylight. You can't afford this luxury. After inventing your new lucidity tonight, open Ezekiel's gates. Travel by light, shooting through veins and gelatinous floating lenses. The packed neurons composing the optic nerves of a peregrine's four-dimensional sight." I read that peregrine falcons have four-dimensional sight, and I was trying to imagine what that would be. But it was a scientific journal, and it was quite difficult to work it out. This poem's called Meaning. Meaning. Thinking back all the time. I live in my memories often, I used to more so before I met my wife Juno, but it's like a book or something. This is kind of when I was a fisherman, commercial fisherman. Meaning, a black summer night, no moon, the thick air drenched with honeysuckle and swamp gum. In a pool of yellow torchlight, on a knife blade, the brand name, Hickey Miffle. I give in to meaninglessness and look up and try to read smudges of ink that a live squid squirts across the seat. Now the smell of the river hones an edge inside my brain. The night sky, Mallarmé's first drafts. Who can I talk to now that you have left the land of the living? The sound of more words? The moon rolls out from the side of a mountain, and I decide to earn the rent. The net pours into a thick chop, a line of green fire running before the moon's light. Does 4-inch mesh have anything to say tonight? The Mulloway might think so, if they could. Ah, Wordsworth, why were you so human? On Friday nights I fork out comfort, but tonight I work with holes, with absence. I feed out half a mile of mesh, pulling the oars. This comes once a life, a song without words, a human spider spinning a death web across the bay. Alcohol, my friend, my dark perversion, here's to your damage. Who do you think you are? My mother, the belly dancer, my father, silence, my house that repeats itself wherever I go. And then I read this one. This is a poem I wrote, another poem I wrote for my wife Juno. When I met her, I was drinking all the time. A lot of drinking, like a bottle of Jack Daniels a day sort of thing. And she didn't realise that I was kind of a functioning alcoholic. I could still speak without slurring my words. But she found all these bottles of whiskey under my bed and said, "What's all this?" And she said, "Look, it's either me or the alcohol. I can't be responsible for watching you die." And so I left her and went back up to my grandfather's place on the river and looked up at the stars and thought, wow, she was pretty good. Okay, let's try that. Let's try not drinking. That took a while. It took 8 weeks. in a locked room, more or less in her front room, going crazy. So this is the poem about all that. This, I shouldn't have said all that. This says it all. it's a bit blunt when you go straight into it. The kingfisher's soul. A wave hits the shoreline of broken boulders, explodes, fans into fine spray, a fluid wing, then drops back onto the tide, a spume of arterial blood. Our eyes can be gulled by what the brain takes in. Our spirits take flight each time we catch sight out. Feathers of smoke dissolve in air as we glide towards clarity. In the old days, I used to think art that was purely imagined could fly higher than anything real. Now I feel a small fluttering bird in my own pulse, a connection to sky. Back then, a part of me was only half alive. Your breath blew a thicket of smoke from my eyes and brought that half to life. There's no evidence, nothing tangible, no philosopher of blood to consider the possibilities, weighing up feathers or souls. One day, some evidence could spring from shadows, as my body did in rejecting the delicious poisons, the lure of dark song. You came with a wind in your gaze, flinging away trouble's screw. Laughing at the king of hell's weird command, you created birthdays with the cheekbones of family. I was up, gliding through life and my fabrications, thoughts soft cradle. I scoured memory's tricks from my own memory, its shots and scorecards, those ambiguous lyrics. Clear bird song was not human song. Hearing became nets and shadowy vibrations, the purring air full of whispers and lies. I felt blank pages, indentations created by images, getting by with the shapes I made from crafted habit. You taught me how to weigh the harvest of light. There was a bright innocence in your spelling. I learned to read again through wounded eyes. Wispy spiders withdrawal sparked with static electricity across skin, tiny veins, a tracery, live coppery wires conducting pain to nerve patterns, all lightweight to your blood's iron. You brought along a new light to live in as well as read with. Before you came, whenever I caught a glimpse of my own blood, it seemed a waterfall of bright cells as it bled away. This clouds of euphony created by its loss became holes in thinking, pretend escape hatches, a rush, wings through channels of my coronary arteries. We slept together when you conjured a bed in your Paddington treehouse. Barbless hours. Peace appeared and said, soon a future awaits you. I preferred the cover of night, yet here I stepped into the day by following your gaze. I'll just read to you. I'll finish off with a couple of that I had in mind to read earlier, but I got lost there. I went on this long kind of winding road. These two are good ones to end on. They're not as sort of dense or something. When we were last here, we saw an exhibition of Joseph Cornell's tools. And this is a poem I wrote about that last visit to America. We went to Boulder, Colorado, as well. Joseph Cornell's tools. Joseph Cornell used these sturdy tools and instruments to create boxes, time machines, constructions made from bits and pieces, three-dimensional frames containing bands, lace, feathers, other once ephemeral objects, including a torn fragment of photography, an image of Mallarmé's hands. One contains an illustration of a hummingbird, It seems to hover in the space between the glass and the backing of the box. In another, an etching of a great horned owl. I liked, like the bird I watched one night, perched on a light post in Boulder, Colorado. It swoops from memory, filling my study with silent flight, as I recall another visitation. This afternoon, returning from the post office, I drove ahead of an approaching storm. Trees shook and a black cockatoo flew out from them. It sailed on, just ahead of my car, for almost a minute, a long time, given the situation, stroking the air before the windscreen, following the road, so close I could see details of the plumage, two red patches across the tail feathers, something other than beautiful, fleeting. Something fleeting, yeah. Okay, and this is the last one. I think I'll read one more. This is a... Yeah. A poem that I wrote about a young poet who lived in Sydney in Melbourne and came to Sydney. He was like 18 years old, and he was brilliant, really brilliant young poet who had one small book that was picked up by everybody. And he had a lot of acid, and his father committed suicide under a tree on his property, and Charles went and got the same rifle and sat under the same tree and shot himself. I knew him very closely, and so, but this is a tribute to him, I guess. The great auk for Charles Buckmaster. Birding in Boulder with Merrill, the Rockies behind us, as we walked by Walden Ponds, listening to warblers. We talked about great auks. Evidently, they once lived throughout North America, throughout the Atlantic, from Norway, Greenland, Iceland, right down to the Gulf of St. Lawrence. There were rumors of great auks in Ireland, and in our conversation, they came pouring out of Jack Collum's great auk poem into the air, around our heads. Though they were long extinct and unable to fly, I mentioned that many years ago, there was a poetry journal called The Great Auk, published for a season or two in Melbourne, edited by a young poet named Charles Buckmaster. Once it travelled to Sydney and charmed the bookshop people who offered it sanctuary for a while. Charles spoke of auk bones discovered in Massachusetts, fragments put together by the archaeologist of mourning, Kingfisher of poets. Charles wrote for the Lost Forest and opened new pages as he walked the streets of Melbourne, writing back the great auks, speaking of branches to sing from. As the growth rings thickened our lives, he stretched himself, imagining pilchards in massive schools, turning the ocean silver with auk food. Auks returning in poems, swimming from the heads of poets into the tides of our words. Okay.